2 Corinthians chapter 11, we got down through verse 15 last week. We'll pick it up this morning in verse 16. Paul writes, I say again, let no one think me a fool. If otherwise, at least receive me as a fool, that I also may boast a little. What I speak not according to the Lord, but as it were, foolishly, in this confidence of boasting. Seeing that many boast according to the flesh, I also will boast. For you put up with fools gladly, since you yourself are wise. For you put up with it if one brings you into bondage, if one devours you, if one takes from you, if one exalts himself, if one strikes you on the face. To our shame, I say, that we were too weak for that. But in whatever anyone is bold, I speak foolishly, I am bold also. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they of the seed of Abraham? So am I. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool, I am more. In labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequently, in deaths often. From the Jews, 5 times I received 40 stripes minus one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have been in the deep. In journeys often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness, besides the other things which comes upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. Who is weak and I am not weak? Who is made to stumble and I do not burn with indignation? If I must boast, I will boast in the things which concern my infirmity. The God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who is blessed forever, knows that I am not lying. In Damascus, the governor, under Aretas, the king, was guarding the city of the Damascenes with a garrison, desiring to arrest me. But I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall and escaped from his hands. As I studied this passage and put together my thoughts for this morning, what hit me hardest was the stark contrast. Here I was, sitting at home, sheltered from the elements. I was comfortable, warm, secure, at peace. I was reading Paul's words with a cup of coffee in my hand. It had cream and artificial sweetener in it, no less. There was also enough food in our kitchen to feed a dozen neighbors. Spilling milk on my laptop that morning was the biggest trial I faced the whole day. I suppose the words that best described me that day was at ease. And after reading the last half of 2 Corinthians 11, I wondered what the Apostle Paul would have thought about my version of living for Christ in contrast to his. There are Christians today who have a far more troubling life than you or I. We sit in our padded chairs in our climate-controlled sanctuary and worship God freely, while believers from Muslim lands get jailed, their property gets confiscated, they're killed or they run out of their own country. Let me say, it seems foolish for me to be talking to you about beatings and shipwrecks and hunger. What do I know about sleeplessness often when I usually go home on Sundays after church and take a nap? This kind of talk from a person with my advantages seems foolish. And yet I take comfort in the fact that this kind of talk also seemed foolish to Paul. He was embarrassed to bring up his sacrifices and his sufferings for Jesus' sake. For even the greatest sacrifice, even a lifetime of suffering, pales in comparison to the eternal God leaving heaven, the holy God taking on our sin, the loving God subjecting himself to man's hate, the living God dying in our place, all to redeem us to himself. Whether our calling from God is a quiet life of humble dedication, or a brave life of persecution and hardship. We're foolish to brag about what we've done. All the glory, all the honor belongs to Jesus. Our lot in life is set by God's will, and His grace is sufficient for whatever demands His providence might place on us. Well, with that in mind, Paul begins in verse 16. I say again, let no one think me a fool. If otherwise, at least receive me as a fool, that I also may boast a little. Now, in chapter 11, Paul does something that he avoids doing almost everywhere else. He boasts. He acts the fool by focusing on himself. In any discussion involving the gospel of grace, why would we ever put the spotlight on our own portfolio? Grace is love that's on the house. It's unmerited. It's undeserved. Its origin is God's heart, not our works. That means it's not about me. It's all about Jesus. To boast in my own achievements is truly foolish. Some of you might recall Mr. T. You remember Mr. T? He was the beloved tough guy of the 1980s. He was on the A-team. He even slipped into a Rocky film. And one thing Mr. T didn't like was fools. Mr. T had a famous expression, "I pity the fool." You remember that? Actually, Mr. T, or Lawrence Turod, his real name, is a Christian. In fact, he's a cancer survivor who credits the book of Job for getting him through with his faith intact. After Hurricane Katrina, Turod stopped wearing gold chains out of respect for the people who had lost everything in the floods. Today, he boldly shares his faith and pities the fool who doesn't bow to Jesus. Ordinarily, like Mr. T, the Apostle Paul would pity the fool who talked only about his own experiences rather than highlight the grace that is in Christ. But you see, Paul's critics in Corinth had placed him in a difficult situation. Here in 2 Corinthians 11, Paul was forced to boast. The false teachers in Corinth were proud and arrogant. They called themselves super apostles as they questioned Paul's apostolic calling and credibility. His character was the target of their attacks on the gospel. Thus, by defending the legitimacy of his own ministry, Paul was defending the power of the gospel. This is why Paul says in verse 16 that he needs to boast a little. He's about to indulge in a little foolishness. As he said in verse 1, a little folly. In essence, he's saying, consider me a fool if you want, but I'm not acting foolish. I'm acting of necessity. So he writes, what I speak not according to the Lord, but as it were, foolishly, in this confidence of boasting. Now, normally, Paul would never, ever spend a whole chapter talking about himself. Most often, Paul would follow Jesus' example. He would assume a low profile. He would identify with other people. He would humble himself. He would see himself as a servant and do all he could to point to another. Paul was about Jesus, not tooting his own horn. Yet to prove his own loyalty to the gospel, in these chapters, the apostle does talk about the sacrifices he's made. He talks about the scars that he bore for the gospel's sake. He says in verse 18, seeing that many boast according to the flesh, I also will boast. Boasting was unusual for Paul, but not for the Corinthians. It was their favorite pastime. They were always talking about their advantages and their accomplishments. The false prophets in Corinth were legalists. They weren't trusting in grace, they were trusting in grunt. That's why they were so quick to highlight their own charity and their piety and their good works. They bragged in the flesh, in their own human achievements. And here Paul is stooping to their level in a sense. He's also going to brag about himself and about his works, not to earn God's favor, but to show the results of grace in his life. Now, to grasp the next verse, you got to read it with some sarcasm. Paul writes, for you put up with fools gladly, since you yourselves are wise. The Corinthians were so stuck up, they perceived themselves as so wise. If they were in the habit of tolerating foolish boasts, why not put up with Paul's foolishness for a few moments? Paul isn't doing anything that they didn't usually welcome. In fact, the Corinthians didn't just tolerate the proud and selfish boasting of the false prophets. They put up with all kinds of foolishness from these supposed men of God. Paul writes in verse 20, "For you put up with it if one brings you into bondage, if one devours you, if one takes from you, if one exalts himself, if one strikes you on the face." As I mentioned last week, over the years, it has amazed me at the abuse gullible Christians, church members, willingly take from their so-called spiritual leaders. There are pastors who use their clout, their supposed spiritual authority, to misuse and to abuse people for their own ends. Notice the crimes here done by these false apostles: put in bondage, devour, take, exalt himself, strike. Here's the modus operandi of a false man of God. Here's how bogus pastors manipulate and control their flock: through bondage. They're great at these little legalistic guilt trips. They expect the people to adopt their unbiblical norms. By pushing people around, they feel more important. They devour. Rather than feed the sheep, they feed on the sheep. They prey on people rather than pray for people. The false prophet is a butcher, not a shepherd. They also are on the take. Even when they give to get. For this kind of a pastor, it's what's in it for me. The phony man of God always has ulterior motives. And then they exalt themselves. These false prophets, they inflate themselves. They swell, but they don't grow. And there's a huge difference. Growth adds substance and strength to my life. A man swells when he's inflated, when he exalts himself, when he's just full of hot air. And finally, a false prophet strikes you on the face. A slap on the face in the first century was an insult. The false prophets in Corinth, they manipulated people with insults, with put-downs. They put people down to keep them in line. And here is the mystery. Why would anyone tolerate these kinds of shenanigans in the name of God? Paul was angry at these men passing themselves off as apostles of Christ, but he was also upset at the gullible Corinthians who let them get away with it. And then verse 21, he says, "To our shame, I say that we were too weak for that." Again, notice his sarcasm. Paul's critics had accused him of being weak, and he replies, "Well, I'm glad I'm too weak to abuse you in such a brazen way." If the hypocrisy of the false teachers made them seem strong, then Paul was happy to be viewed as weak. But in whatever anyone is bold, I speak foolishly, I am bold also. And here Paul says he wants to match credentials with these false prophets. Whatever makes these false prophets so bold, so confident, he wants to compare resumes. Paul is inferior to no one. See, the false prophets, they had nothing on Paul, and he sets out to prove it in verse 22. He says, "Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? Well, so am I." Here, Paul's response gives us a clue as to the claims these false teachers in Corinth were making. Apparently, these were Judaizers. These were the infamous arch enemies of the early church in the gospel of grace. These were Jews who saw Christianity as merely a branch of Judaism. Oh, they were okay with this faith in Jesus as long as you first became a Jew, as long as you got circumcised. These Judaizers believed that Gentiles first had to become Jews in order to be saved. And Paul opposed this falsehood everywhere he went. Paul had the perfect Jewish pedigree. A Hebrew? Check. An Israelite? Check. Of Abraham? Check. Yet Paul knows that none of that matters. Paul knew that it's not your birth certificate that makes you pleasing to God. It's whether you've been born again of His Spirit. And that happens by faith in Jesus and faith alone. See, our salvation is a lot like one particular wife's love for her husband. One day, her husband asked, "Honey, did you ever love anyone before me?" Well, the wife sort of thought a bit, and then she replied. She says, "No, darling. I once respected a man for his great intelligence. I admired another man for his remarkable courage. I was captivated by yet another man, by his good looks and charm. But with you, darling, well, how else can I explain it except love?" Well, like the wife's attitude toward her husband, God chooses us not because of our brains or our bravery or our beauty. It's grace. It's only because of His love. And this is why God chose Paul to be an apostle. This is also what motivated Paul to love the foolish Corinthians. God had put a love in his heart for them. In 2 Corinthians, Paul has reminded his readers of his jealousy toward them, his generosity to them. Now he grows even bolder. He enumerates his sufferings for them, all that he endured to bring the gospel to the Gentiles. Understand, every artist has a portfolio. It's a sample of their work. It's a collection of paintings and drawings. And by looking through a portfolio, you can get a feel for the personality of the artist, their style, even their skill. Well, this is what Paul does in the second half of chapter 11. He reveals his ministry's portfolio. He wants the Corinthians to see what kind of minister he truly was. Verse 23, "Are they ministers of Christ? Well, I speak as a fool." Again, Paul is recoiling from this whole idea of boasting. Yet he continues on. "Are they ministers of Christ? I am more. In labors more abundant. In stripes above measure. In prisons more frequently. In deaths often." Paul compares himself with these false teachers by opening up his portfolio, laying out what he had endured for the gospel. But here he breaks with convention. You see, rather than listing his awards and his achievements and his accolades, sort of showing off the best of Paul, instead he enumerates his sufferings and his hardships. There was a document that circulated through the Roman Empire at the time of Paul. It was entitled Rives Justi Divi Augusti. Pardon my Latin. It's translated, "The Deeds of the Divine Augustus." It was actually an obituary written for the first emperor of Rome, Caesar Augustus. It consisted of a short intro followed by 35 paragraphs divided into four sections. First came his political career and advancements. Second was his public benevolence, the good deeds that he did. Third chronicled his military triumphs and conquests. And then fourth was a sonnet of Rome's love for its emperor. Now understand, the Rives Justi was really just Roman propaganda. It ignored mention of Augustus's struggles, of any of his setbacks. It glossed over any blemishes on his record. It was basically a promotional tool. Its whole intention was to put a good facade, a good face on Rome and the emperor. And here, when Paul writes about his ministry, you would think he would do the same thing, that he would fill his portfolio with flattering details. Paul's Rives Justi might include the churches he started, the size of the crowds that he spoke to, the celebrities he reached, the number of people he converted, the miles he traveled, the councils he attended, the disputes he settled, the books he wrote, the visions he saw, the money he raised, the pastors he trained and sent out, certainly the miracles he performed. Instead, Paul's validating deeds, his Rives Justi, was filled with the contrary. The apostle enumerates his sufferings and his setbacks, his hurts and his hardships. Understand, Paul did not adhere to a false gospel. Obey God, and God will guarantee you health and wealth. You'll be rich. To Paul, God wasn't a meal ticket. God wasn't a blessing dispenser where you plug in a prayer and out pops an answer. In fact, the Apostle Paul glories in weakness and in pain and in struggles, for it proved that he served God because he loved God, not because he was loved by God. Every year after Thanksgiving, I meet with a group of Calvary Chapel pastors from the Deep South. Nearly 30 of us all gathered together over in East Alabama at a place called Shaco Springs. Well, we spend 3 days together. We fellowship, we worship, we relax, we play basketball, we just have some fun. But we also have, and we eat, should say that. But we also have some rules. We got some rules. We're serious about these rules. First is the Vegas rule. What goes on in Shaco stays at Shaco. In other words, we want to protect our privacy. We want to be ourselves, protect our privacy. Second, no preaching. No preaching. And since we're all preachers, we know when somebody's doing it. Third, no bragging. I mean, who wants to spend 3 days listening to somebody brag? And then fourth, the pecking order is determined by scars and years. Now, you know what I mean when I talk about a pecking order. In every group, there's a pecking order. Who's the leader? Who's respected? Who's the newbie? Et cetera, et cetera. A pastor having a lot of people come to his church, that doesn't mean much. There's multiple ways to draw a crowd. Get naked or set yourself on fire. People will come and see. Having a nice facility might mean you're affluent, but not necessarily spiritual. No, what the pastors in our group respect are the scars that a man carries. What it cost him to follow Jesus. And how long he survived. His longevity also matters. That's a big deal. You see, this was more like the criteria Paul used to judge the faithfulness of a man's ministry. Scars and struggles. When the troops of Alexander the Great mutinied in 324 BC, the great general, he gave a speech. He said, "Which of you has labored more for me than I did for him? Come now, whoever of you has wounds, let him strip and show them, and I will show mine in turn. For there is no part of my body free from wounds, nor is there any kind of weapon used, the traces of which I do not bear on my person. The sword, arrows, missiles projected from engines of war, stones and bolts of wood, yet I am still leading you as conquerors over all the land and sea." Before Alexander, it was actually fashionable for Greek men to have soft skin. But he set the trend for rugged exteriors. His scars were proof of his leadership and his courage and his commitment to his troops. And this is why chapter 11 endears us so to Paul. Because he shows off his scars. You think you've suffered for Jesus' sake? Listen again to the intro of Paul's Reeves Justy, verse 23. "In labors more abundant, in stripes above measure, in prisons more frequently, in deaths often." And what all is in these pregnant phrases, we have no idea. Notice Paul says, "in prisons," plural. You know, in Acts, we have record of Paul being jailed just once. That's Acts 16 in Philippi. Yet here he mentions he was jailed multiple times. It was his frequent experience. And realize, Roman prisons, they didn't have big screen TVs and bunk beds and hot meals and ping pong tables. These were caves and basements, rat infested, always damp and dark. The only bathroom in these prisons was a bucket in the corner of the room. If a friend didn't bring you food that day, you didn't eat. Understand, when God called Paul to a town to minister, jail time was part of his expectation. When I'm asked to speak at another church or at a pastor's conference, in addition to the impact of bringing God's word, I leave thinking, well, going to be a short flight, get picked up by the airport, Nice little venue, some good worship, large crowd, maybe a comfortable hotel that night, a generous honorarium when I head home. Oh, but when Paul was called to visit a new city with the gospel, in addition to bringing God's word, he was wondering, what will the prison be like? How many lashes will be required when I get beaten? And yet Paul obeyed. And what does he mean here by labors or by in deaths often? Paul was like the cat with nine lives. I mean, how many times did this man barely escape death? We don't know, but we realize it was many. And then he says in verse 24, from the Jews, five times I received 40 stripes minus one. Now, this was the punishment of the synagogue. When a Jew was guilty of blasphemy, his cloak was ripped off his back and he was subjected to the lash. 39 lashes with a cat of nine tails. One Jewish source said, a third were placed on his back, a third on his right shoulder, and a third on his left shoulder. Deuteronomy 25 stipulated 40 lashes. But if the 40 were exceeded, the torturer would then receive the same punishment as he had executed, and so he usually stopped at 39, just in case. I mean, he wanted to make sure that he didn't get carried away or somehow lost count. And five times Paul endured this kind of beating. That's a total of 195 lashes. Imagine Paul when he took off his shirt. There were crisscross scars everywhere. He looked like a waffle griddle. How long does it take to recover from this kind of ordeal? Weeks, months? What happens if the wounds get infected? How did he manage the pain? And this happened to him five times. If it were me, I would have started skipping the synagogue. You know, I get to town, I'm just going straight to the Gentiles. I mean, I don't need another beating. But not Paul. He loved the Jews. Realize what was involved when he commented, the gospel was to the Jew first. Even though that meant torture and beatings for him. It was to the Jew first, and Paul obeyed. He adds, three times I was beaten with rods. Now this was the Roman torture, administered with a bamboo cane. There was no limits to this punishment. It was totally left to the discretion of the local authorities. You know, the book of Acts never mentions Paul's 195 lashes. And only once does it record a Roman beating. Again, Acts chapter 16. And yet Paul endured this torture on two more occasions. He says, once I was stoned. This is mentioned in Acts chapter 14. It happened in Galatia, the town of Lystra. Paul was the victim of the violence of a flash mob. False teachers had convinced the locals he was the enemy. The mob picked up rocks and pelted him and left him for dead. Years later, he would write to the Galatians, and he would mention his scars as proof of his love for them and of his faithfulness to the gospel. Realize in Paul's mind, this was his finest hour. Not when he was on top of the world, honored by men, but when he was under a pile of stones for Jesus' sake. And then he tells us, three times I was shipwrecked. Only one shipwreck is mentioned in the book of Acts, chapter 27. And at this point in the timeline, when this was written, that had yet to occur. Obviously, Paul is speaking of three other disasters at sea. Flimsy wooden vessels, sudden storms, poor navigation, made sea travel in the first century risky business. Just ask Paul. I mean, think of it. Every time the boat he was on drifted away from the dock, he didn't know if he'd ever set foot on dry land again, if he would end up shark bait. And yet Paul crisscrossed thousands of miles over the Mediterranean Sea, bringing the world the gospel of Jesus Christ. He mentions one trip. A night and a day, I had been in the deep. He stayed afloat for 24 hours one time, treading water, maybe holding on to a broken timber. He had to kick away the fish that were nibbling on his legs. He was in journeys often. Imagine the stamps on Paul's passport, the frequent flyer miles he logged, in perils of waters. He didn't just cross seas. He swam across rivers. He trudged along through swamps in perils of robbers. Oh, the ancient world was dangerous. Traveling anywhere was dangerous. You remember Jesus' story of the Good Samaritan? It starts with robbers ambushing a traveler on that windy road that goes from Jericho to Jerusalem. There were few state troopers in the first century. It made travel of any sort a dangerous proposition. In perils of my own countrymen, that is the Jews, in perils of the Gentiles, that's everybody else, Paul was an equal opportunity target. Everybody attacked him. In perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren. In short, Paul encountered opposition from all sides. The life God called Paul to live for the gospel's sake was extreme and difficult and full of a million perils. Paul endured persecution from his enemy, but he also suffered from the execution of his ministry. He says, in weariness and toil. Think of his 18 months there in Corinth. By day, he worked with Aquila and Priscilla in their tent-making business, while by night, he taught the scriptures in their synagogues and in their homes. No time off, no vacation, no personal time, no downtime, no little time for himself. He pressed on for Jesus' sake, in weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness. Hey, the prisons in Paul's day didn't have orange jumpsuits for their inmates. When you were shipwrecked and plucked from the water, the Red Cross wasn't standing by to drape you in a blanket. There were all kinds of situations where Paul found himself shivering and naked, famished and thirsty. In fact, the early church father, John Chrysostom, who lived in the 4th century AD, much closer to New Testament times, in writing of 2 Corinthians 11, he commented that he believed Paul didn't tell the half of all that he suffered for Jesus' sake, that he endured far more than he told us. I mean, do you get a sense of what this man's life was like? Hey, when you have a bad day, I got a suggestion for you. Just read this chapter. I mean, it'll cheer you up. At least your life is not as rough as Paul's. And yet, despite the things that he endured, the scars that he bore in his body, despite these things, it was Paul who writes some of the most lofty theology in all the Bible. He lived in deep communion with God. He possessed unquenchable joy and inexhaustible love. He had faith to see all these trials as a light affliction. Paul could do all things through Christ who strengthened him. He pressed on to know Jesus. So what's our excuse? We get a little headache. We can't come to church. Somebody else can usher today. Are we serious? In light of Paul, we all can buck up a little, don't you think? And to top it all off, I mean, here is the icing on the cake that was Paul's ministry. Verse 28 reads, besides the other things which comes upon me daily, my deep concern for all the churches. This was Paul's most relentless stress. This is the stress from which he could never escape. It wasn't the perils, it wasn't the robbers, it wasn't the prisons, it wasn't the labors. His greatest stress was his care and concern for the churches. Here's what dominated Paul's thoughts, filled up his waking hours, kept him up at night. It was his daily concern that he carried for the spiritual health of the churches he planted and essentially still pastored. There were so many ways these new Christians and these young churches could go sideways. Some were immature. Some were filled with false doctrine. Some were divided. Some were carnal. Some were preyed upon by wolves in sheep's clothing. And Paul cared for them all. He paid them visits. He wrote them letters. Oh, we're thankful for those letters. We still read them. He sent them representatives. If it were today, Paul would have texted and tweeted and posted and Facebooked. And certainly, most importantly, Paul prayed for these churches. All his other cares were secondary compared to the deep concern that Paul had for these many churches. The language in verse 28 is so descriptive. When Paul writes, "What comes upon me daily," think of someone being smothered under a blanket. It speaks of an intolerable load, something that you don't just shake off. And as a pastor, here's where I can relate to Paul. For though I drink my coffee in the morning with cream and sweetener, and I sit on a comfortable couch in my climate-controlled living room, I too am concerned for the people that I pastor. Even on my day off, I'm really not off. I still think of you. I still care for this church, as well as the many other churches with which I'm affiliated. Calvary Chapel is my deep concern. Some of you might be aware of what's going on within Calvary Chapel nationally. One of the pastors branched off to start a new association with a different emphasis. And for the first time in 30 years, the unity we've enjoyed in Calvary Chapel is now in question. As a Calvary Chapel pastor and as a Calvary Chapel council member, this grieves me deeply. I care about this. I've spent hours thinking and praying about this. I've worked hard to respond appropriately. A few weeks ago, I saw a group of pastors who were posting on a private blog, and they were criticizing how we, as leaders in Calvary Chapel, could let such a thing happen. I wrote them this: "This has not been easy on any of us. It has taken a toll on me personally. My pastor asked me to take a seat at the table. Perhaps some of you could have done a better job. It seems you think so, but I have taken this responsibility seriously, and I am doing my best. To think any of you would approach this flippantly is insulting." To think that any of us would be flippant about these matters. How could you think that? A fellow pastor should know the deep concern that God puts into a pastor's heart for the church. And recently I felt concern as never before. In verse 29, Paul writes, Who is weak and I am not weak? Who is made to stumble and I do not burn with indignation? Paul cared for the weak and fragile, since he saw himself as one of them. Paul too was needy. Thus, when someone weak in the faith was taken advantage of or caused to stumble, Paul got angry. He burned with indignation over these things. He wasn't afraid to defend a weaker believer. Paul wraps up his portfolio, or his Reeves Justy, by stating in verse 30, "If I must boast, I will boast in the things which concern my infirmity." The proof of his ministry's legitimacy wasn't in his attendance stats or in his bank statements. It was in his scars. Paul didn't point to his stars, but to his scars. And Paul closes with his own Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain story. He says, "The God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who is blessed forever, knows that I am not lying." Now understand, the buildup here makes you assume that he's going to bring up a miracle, some kind of outlandish story. Paul is going to brag on some supernatural feat, so he calls on God to assure us that he's not lying. You figure, wait a minute. Paul's going to tell a story that's going to just sound too good to be true. We're all going to want to Google it later, check it out if it's true or not. I mean, what great exploit is he going to point to validate his ministry? And here it is. "In Damascus, the governor, under Aretas the king, was guarding the city of the Damascenes with a garrison, desiring to arrest me. But I was let down in a basket through a window in the wall and escaped from his hands." Wait a minute. What does Paul pull out of his portfolio to demonstrate the faithfulness of his ministry? I mean, how do you top off your resume? What is the best hits of Paul? He could have talked about preaching in Athens or planting churches in Asia or converting Caesar's own household. It's not what he does. How about sneaking out of town? Paul was lured in a basket from a wall in Damascus. The Apostle Paul left town, not in a ticker tape parade, but in a clandestine escape. He went out with the trash. This is not going to be the picture on his promotional packet, that's for sure. But here's the point. The false teachers in Corinth said that God chose them because of their exceptional talents, their great righteousness. Paul said just the opposite. According to worldly criteria, according to human standards, Paul was nothing special. He was weak and he was needy, and yet God in his grace chose him to do mighty things. Here's the lesson for us. Follow the man who depends on God's grace, not the proud man who boasts in himself. When it comes to the pastor who loves the spotlight, as Mr. T would say, pity the fool. Paul lived his life to the glory of God, and so should we.